Morning, everyone. Today's daf is Sadi Zion. Thank the Lubin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. We are in the 11th parak of Ksuvos. We started the 11th parak of Ksuvos yesterday. We didn't get that far into it. We're in the very top of Sadi Vav Amud Aleph. And we are somewhere towards the top. We're starting with the words today. Amar Rav Yossi Rebbe Chanina. 11th parak is the continuation of responsibilities that a estate has to the widow. We know that when a woman is married to a man, so there are a number of exchanges, a number of financial responsibilities that are exchanged between the two of them. And this takes us all the way back to Daf Mem Zayin and the Ksuvos, where the Gemara articulates over there that there are a number of things where he does for her, and as in reciprocity, she has to do for him. So over here now, we're late in the Masechta, the 11th parak, the 13 altogether. So late in the Masechta, now we're going to be moving the discussion to what happens when she's a widow, and then what becomes the responsibility of the estate, meaning the children, towards her. So we learned back in the Mishnah that as far as mezonos are concerned, so the obligation of the estate is to give her mezonos, to provide for her mezonos. Until what point? So as we pointed out, that was a regional debate in terms of when exactly the mezonos are going to expire. So the machlok is between Anshe Galil and Anshe Yehuda. So according to Anshe Galil, so it is indefinite until she no longer is a widow, meaning until she is either dead or remarried. So that is the minhag Anshe Galil. Anshe Yehuda extended it for as long as the estate wanted to. When does the estate terminate their mizonos? So when they pay off the rest of the ksuva. So when they pay off the balance of the settlement to the ksuva, so then and only then are they going to no longer have to pay mezonos, but they have that option.
When do we go by?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. So clearly it's a regional debate, so I'm not sure if this is the kind of thing where I understand your question. I don't know. So fine, that's what we learned in the Mishnah. The another thing we learned in the Mishnah is that there's no obligation for the estate to bury her, meaning it is her, anyone who's Yerusha, anyone who inherits her, they have the obligation to bury her. If she would have predeceased the husband, then the husband would have inherited her, and therefore the husband would have the obligation to bury her. That's part of the Tanai Ksuva. Ksuva Tachas Kfura. That he's going to get the Ksuva. Now when we say he gets the Ksuva, that means that he doesn't have to pay the settlement, but that's not getting anything. But B, he's going to get anything that she included in the ksuva at the time of the marriage. The nedunya, the nechsei tzon barzel, that she included into the marriage. So that's something that he's going to be receiving in exchange for that. He has an obligation to bury her. So let's say she is a widow and then she dies. So the estate has no obligation to bury her, but rather her yorshim, her those who inherit her, those are the ones who are going to have to bury her.
The tzon barzel also goes to the husband? Or tzon barzel goes to her children?
Nope, goes to the husband. If she predeceases him, it goes to the husband.
Even tzon barzel?
Yeah,
But the father of the bride has in mind
to go through. Right now, remember though, in other words, there will be a catch, and that is that if he married multiple wives and they had children from both of those wives, so in terms of the division of the estate, then they'll say that that's going to be restructured in terms of the children. But in terms of the husband's concern, he's going to inherit it. That's correct.
The ransom drops off. Huh? The responsibility for the ransom drops off.
Yeah, in other words, right. That it's funny. The Mishnah doesn't even bring that up, but I assume that's also no longer enforced if we're just talking about the estate. Okay, that's essentially what we saw yesterday. What about Metzia? We learned yesterday that Metzia does not have to go to the estate. She picks something up. She finds something. She has a wonderful discovery, a windfall. So that doesn't have to go to the estate. Although her Masi Adam have to go to the estate, but again, the Masi Adam is exchanged for Mizonos. She's getting Mizonos from the estate, so therefore her earnings are going to go to the estate. That's clear. But the Metzia, however, the Gemara said yesterday, the Metzia doesn't go to the estate. That stays by her. It's true that there will be some animosity where she gets a windfall and she doesn't have to give it to the estate, but as the Gemara pointed out yesterday, okay, and there'll be a little bit of animosity. Meaning, unlike a husband and wife where the Chachamim do everything within their power to promote Shalom Bayis and to create a feeling of reciprocity, you know, I'll do for you, you do for me, but over here, it's we're talking about the estate. The estate simply have financial responsibility to support her, and so therefore, even though there will be some things that are going to create a little bit of acrimony, so the Gemara says that's okay, that's tolerable.
Why does Ava only works one way?
What do you mean?
Why does a husband, because Mishameva, so it belongs to the husband.
Right, well, but again, he does...
Why, what about her, Ava? I mean, she likes to keep it. It only works one way.
I understand. I guess she's whatever. I do understand, but it's, you know, I
as well.
Okay, that's true. Okay, fine. That's certainly a possibility. Also, I guess it just, if you think about all these exchanges, meaning so many things that she's relinquishing to him.
Takes care of her.
So right, and he takes care of her. So in other words, it kind of fits in. It fits into what is, you know, quote unquote, normally accepted. Okay, and we're continuing, and we're on the towards the top of Tzadi Vav Amid Aleph. We'll start with the words. Amar Rabbi Yosi. It's about 10 lines from the top. Amar Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Chinna, Kol Malacha Shaisha Osa Labal Amanos Ela Yorshim. Okay, there are a number of activities that we identified earlier in the Masechta where a wife has to do for her husband. Okay, the Malachos. Right, if I'm not mistaken, I think there were 7 activities altogether where the wife has to do. She has to grind, she has to bake, she has to cook, or she has to wash. Okay, so the basic household chores that the wife is responsible to do, so she also has to do that for the Yerushim as well. And the exception to that would be those activities that she does for the husband, but really those for the purpose of creating intimacy between her and the husband. Right, the pouring of the wine, literally the dilution of the wine, but the pouring of the wine, the making of the bed, the washing of the hands, feet, and face. These are things that the wife does for the husband as part of her responsibility for her husband. But here, though, she doesn't do this for the kids. Meaning that these aren't functional activities that she does in the household. These are just simply ways of creating more intimacy and closeness between her and her husband. And obviously, that's far from inappropriate. That is inappropriate for her and her and the kids. I'm Rav Yeshua Malevi. Kom lachos shaha eved osa l'rabba tamid osa l'rabba. Anything that a slave does for his master, so a student has to do for his rebbe. In other words, the kind of service requirement that an Eved has for his master. So basically, we're going to look at the relationship of a Talmud Rebbe in more or less the same way. Except for taking off the shoe. So that's something that the Talmud does not need to do for the Rebbe. But short of that, Talmud has to basically service his Rebbe and all other forms of your basic service. Please don't ask me what exactly does a Eved have to do for his Rav. I mean, where exactly are those requirements listed? I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure where they're listed. But anyway, fine. That's the kind of relationship that a Talmud should have to his Rebbe. Amar Rav lo amar nol b'makushe makirnoso. B'makushe makirnoso leislan b'am. Now, before I read Rav, I should have pointed out the following. Let me give a little more explanation, a little svara. Why is it that the Talmud shouldn't untie the shoe of his Rebbe? Meaning, if it's your Rebbe and you're going to service your Rebbe and you're going to attend to your Rebbe, so do everything. What's so bad about untying the shoe? So if you took a look at Rashi, so Rashi says the problem with it is chutz me'ataras menal. It's a short Rashi. Shavra omer evik kananihu. Because once you see him doing that to his Rebbe, not his Rabbo, but his Rebbe, once you see him doing that, so then you're going to say to yourself, that's interesting. I guess he's an Eved Kenani. Who knew? But I guess he is. Look, he's serving like an Eved Kenani, so I guess he is an Eved Kenani. You know, you are what you do. So generally speaking, so as much as you want to try to redefine, we want to redefine ourselves, but basically you are what you do. So, okay, so they see him behaving like an Eved Kenani. I guess he's an Eved Kenani. The problem with that, of course, is yichus and marriage, and you're trying to make a shidduch. Oh, don't make a shidduch with him. He's an Eved Kenani. I mean, good guy, but just, you know, you can't marry him. So basically, there's a line that we have to draw somewhere in the sand that demarcates that he's not an Eved Kenani. And that line's going to be the not taking off the shoe. So, but in every other way, he should serve his Rebbe. So now, okay, good. Now that we said that, now we'll understand Rava. So now let's go back to the Gemara. Let's say over Rava. I'm Rava. Lomar nel b'makushim makirnoso. Ava b'makushim makirnoso leitzan ba. Good. So Rava says, well, let's say everybody knows who he is, and there's no one's going to confuse him with an Eved Kenani. So then there's no problem of perception. Now you can fully serve your Rebbe. Baruch Hashem. So I'm Rava. Shiv b'makushim makirnoso. Nami lomar nel adolam manach tefillin. Ava manach tefillin leitzan ba. And the Gemara makes another suggestion. Suggestion proviso, and that is, let's say that it's clear that he's not an Eved Kenani, i.e. he's wearing tefillin. Eved Kenani, we know, is obligated in mitzvahs in the Torah, but only the mitzvahs of the Torah that a woman is obligated in. A woman is exempt from the mitzvah of tefillin. Eved Kenani is exempt from the mitzvah of tefillin. So you won't be finding an Eved Kenani wearing tefillin. So if you now are wearing tefillin, so now once again, it's a clear demonstration that you're not Nevi-Kanani. So once again, now you're in a position where you could fully serve your Rebbe, and there doesn't have to be any inhibition whatsoever, no misperception because you're wearing tefillin, and the Gemara says good. So now you can fully serve your Rebbe, including taking off his shoes.
Why would he do it while wearing the tefillin?
They used to wear tefillin all day. That was their day.
Yeah, but it's not a bazillion for the tefillin.
Right. I guess. Maybe you removed. I hear you. I hear your point. Maybe you removed the shalyad. Maybe. Or, you know, just untie the hand. We spoke very briefly about the responsibility of the Talmud serving his Rebbe. How should the Rebbe approach this? Meaning, should the Rebbe encourage this kind of behavior where basically your Talmud is going to serve you? Or should you discourage it? So to that, the Gemara quotes a statement by Rav Yochanan, and that is encouragement. If you are Monet, if you prevent your student from serving you, it's like you're preventing chesed from him. In other words, it's good. You have a mitzvah of honoring your rebbeim, right? The mor rabcha kamor shamayim, the honor of your rebbe should be like the fear of heaven. And so the rebbe's position is okay. He shouldn't discourage it. He shouldn't. I'm not sure about encouraging. Also, the word the Gemara uses is moneya, meaning don't stop him. Okay, so Shinamar, and the Gemara quotes a pasuk lamas meiru chesed. So the withholding from your friend chesed, the pasuk from Eov. Rashi says either we learn it from this part of the pasuk. Rashi makes a suggestion that we learn it from the first part of the pasuk. Of course, that would require us to know the first part of the pasuk. But anyway, a pasuk that speaks to this idea that you're withholding chesed from somebody if you don't let him serve you properly. Excuse me. Rav Nachman Yisak Amar Av Parek Mimenu Yerushalayim. Rav Nachman goes one step further. If you prevent your Talmud from serving you, you're going to be removing from him Yerushalayim. He'll have an inferior fear of heaven because he's not serving his Rebbe like he should. Shenemar V'Yerasa Shakai Yazov. Okay, I'm sorry. V'Yerushalayim Yazov. Amar Rebbe Lazar. Okay, those are your four lines of. I'm not even sure if it's Agadata. I don't know. I wouldn't even file it under Agadata. But in other words, some ideas not necessarily related to our topic, but okay, good. So a student should be serving his Rebbe. The Amar Rebbe Lazar. V'amana shetafsa metaltam b'mezanasa ma shetafsa tafsa. Okay, back to our widow. Our widow is taking metaltam because she is in need of mezonos. Again, we start off with the 11th parak, beginning with the basic yisod, that when a woman becomes a widow, so it's the responsibility of the estate to support her. And that is obviously critical for her survival. So now, let's just imagine for a moment that whatever the estate is, laying on payment. Okay? So now, this is mezonos. These are daily needs. So she's entitled to do a tfisa. She could do a seizure. And seizure over here means not like Beis Din, but like her coming in and saying, okay, I don't know what happened to payment. Payment came in late. I need to eat. So she can come in and she could take. And masha tafsa tafsa. And whatever she takes is considered taken. Meaning we have general, we find this throughout the Gemara. We saw a couple of these examples earlier in our Masechta. Sometimes seizures are legal. Sometimes seizures are illegal. If seizures are illegal, so then obviously, you know, you're gonna just have to give it back. But over here, what's done is done. The Gemara quotes a brisa. The Gemara quotes a brisa that says this as well. There was the daughter-in-law of Rabbi Shabtai. So she took a bag full of money. The Chachamim had no part to take it away from her. In other words, she was entitled and needed mezonos, and therefore she took. Okay, so the Gemara now is going to make a demarcation. That's true, that she can take, and she has the ability to seize assets in order to pay. And by the way, I'm not sure if I made this point very clear. I'll try to make it even clearer. In other words, generally speaking, when we're talking about seizure, we're talking about seizure of property. Over here, we're talking about seizure of metaltolin, meaning she can go into the house and take even movable items. I mean, the story that the Gemara just told us with the daughter-in-law Rabbi Shabtai is that she came in and she took a bag of money. That's metaltolin. And so over here, her need for mezonos is so basic and so real, and it allows her to seize even metaltolin. And generally speaking, metaltolin creates no obligation for the secures no obligation from the point of the estate, But again, we're talking about mezonos, and therefore she could take even metalklin. Okay. Third wide line down. Amar Ravina v'lomar ela mezone. Her ability to come and to grab is only for her mezonos. Aval l'ksuva mafkina my name. But let's say she grabs for her ksuva. So there, we take it away from her. Meaning, she does not have the right to take for her ksuva. The matkev lama baravashi maishna luksuva de mekarkev lama tatle mizonos nami me mekarkev lama tatle. So mar baravashi says, I don't understand. Look, by the ksuva, there's not going to be any disagreement. But do you know why? Because it's very simple. Because like we've said so many times, the only thing that secures the ksuva is real estate. It's going to be the properties that are securing the ksuva. The metaltalin are not going to be there to create any type of shibud against her ksuva. So good. So that means when she comes in, she takes metaltalin, she says, look, I didn't get paid my ksuva. She comes in, she starts seizing. So that's going to be totally illicit. That's illegal. Now again, she's holding a note, so she'll go to Beis Din, she'll take the kids to Beis Din. That's not the point. The point is that she just can't simply come in and grab metalton. The metalton don't have any security against the obligation. So Marba Ravashi says, good. We all agree to that. There's no disagreement. So what's the difference between that and mezonos? Meaning what gives her the right and the ability to come in and to take metalton for her mezonos? He says he says, I don't see the difference. Ella, and it's an interesting conclusion. So now that he says, I don't see the difference, so which way we're going to go? Meaning, we're going to be consistent. But which way we're going to be consistent? This is interesting. Ella mezone mai tetafsa tafsa, hachanam l'ksuva. So just like by mezonos, what's taken is taken, and therefore we're not going to condone this kind of behavior, but we understand it, and what she takes is hers. So same thing with ksuva as well. Masha also asui. Whatever she takes is hers. It's funny. In other words, it's a little bit strange, the construction of argument over here. We all know that it's only property that serves as a lien against her obligation. So it's true by ksuva. So it's true by mezonos. So therefore, I don't see the difference. And therefore, masha tafsa tafsa. What she takes is hers. It's funny. I would have, you know, if anything, I mean. Meaning, I guess the point of the Gemara is it's just so absurd to imagine that she needs mezonos, she's entitled to mezonos, and she can't come in and just, she can't get, just grab for mezonos. I guess the Gemara couldn't see it any other way. Meaning, it has to be that she's able to do a tefisa for mezonos, and I guess once we allow her to do a tefisa for mezonos, we also allow her to do for ksuva as well. Excuse me. Amalei Rav Yitzchak bar Naftali Ravina. Hachar min mishmei derava kavasech. So Rav Yitzchak bar Naftali says to Ravina, you know, Rav says just like you, meaning a difference. Meaning mizonos, she could do a tefisa. For a ksuva, she can't do a tefisa. Okay. I'm Rav Yochanan Mishmei, the Rav Yosef bar Zimra. Amana sheshas ashtam v'shalashanim v'lo tava mizonos, ivda mizonos. Is there ever going to be a forfeiture of her mizonos? So what we're about to learn now is yes, but it's limited. So the Gemara quotes a statement by Rav Yochanan in the name of Rav Yosef ben Zimri that if the widow waits 2 or 3 years without demanding her mizonos, so she loses her mizonos. Now, there really are two questions that we have to ask right now. And question number one, are we talking about, okay, correct, are we talking about past or for future? And number two, meaning what exactly is it that is stating her what's making us understand that she that's an automatic forfeiture of her ksuva? So both those questions are going to be answered, one explicitly and one kind of implicitly. So hashta shayim ibda shalosh mebayi. So the Gemara is bothered by another very simple question. In other words, you go about two or three years, and she doesn't ask for a mezonos, so she forfeits it. To which, in other words, we've done this a number of times in the Gemara. When you're giving halacha, so halacha is a law. So, and it's a little bit strange that the law is, give it about 2 or 3 years, and she doesn't ask for mezonos, and, okay, well, in other words, tell me what the law is. Is it 2 or is it 3? That's what bothers the Gemara. So the Gemara says the reason why there's a range is because there are different type of widows. So lo kasha kam baniya kam bashira. So, one suggestion the Gemara makes is that we're talking about a wealthy widow versus an impoverished widow. So, a wealthy widow, so obviously she has, her cash flow is not as much of an issue as somebody who is a poor widow. And so, for a wealthier widow, so she can go 2 years and, okay. And so, you know, in other words, I'm okay. Baruch Hashem. I don't have as much cash flow issue. So so for her, if she goes 2 years and she doesn't demand her mizonos, that doesn't mean that that forfeits her mizonos. She'll have to go 3 years, and only after then is that assumed forfeiture of her mizonos. When it comes to the Aniya, just the opposite. She does have a cash flow issue. I mean, it's not a cash flow issue. It's that she just simply doesn't have cash. So for her, if she goes 2 years without asking for mizonos, so that's an assumption of a forfeiture of her mizonos. Inami kambe prutza kambe tsnua. The Gemara also points out that it could also be just based on a personality issue, meaning some women are introverted, some women are extroverted. Prutza tsnua over here, I don't think means like in the classic sense of, you know, lascivious behavior. It just simply means, is she ready to go out and make her demands, or is she more quiet and stay at home? So the Gemara says that could be another distinction. If she's somebody who is more extroverted and she is not shy, so she'll go out and she'll ask. And if 2 years go by, for her, that's a big deal. She's gone 2 years now without asking, and this is not a shy woman. So for her, that's a forfeiture of mizonos. However, if it's more of a stay at home, where she's just quieter and just, you know, that's just more reserved. So for her, 3 years now becomes significant, where at that point in time, if 3 years have gone and she's not asked, so then she forfeits her mizonos. Okay, but still haven't answered some of the most basic questions. What does that mean, she forfeits her mizonos? Amar Rava, la maran elamafreya, avala haba yeshla. So Rava clarifies. When we say that she forfeits her mizonos, we're not talking about from this point going forward, she still needs to eat. The estate still has an obligation to support her. We're only talking about past support. So 2 or 3 years go by and she hasn't asked, so that is only going to be a forfeiture of her past support, not a forfeiture of her, of any future support.
That's what they make it up for the past, doing what? You know, food?
Back pay.
That makes sense.
Back pay.
But then it will be brought to her husband, no?
No, the husband's, the husband's dead. We're talking about a widow.
Oh, no, here we're talking about a widow.
Yeah, yeah.
Social Security does the same thing if you don't claim your widow.
Right. So, correct.
Yes.
So, it's good for people to know that. By Rav Yochanan, you saw me more than a stanovi. Okay, and now we're going to deal with a very basic issue, and that is a simple dispute between widow and the estate. Okay, this is just terrible to envision, but halachically, it's just such a basic question. So now you have a dispute between widow and the estate. Widow is saying she's entitled to mizonos and she hasn't collected, and the estate is saying, no, what are you talking about? We gave it to you. So Almi Lavi Raya, burden of proof falls on whom? And you all know at this point in time what the fundamental issue is, and the fundamental issue is who is the muchzak, who is considered the holder of the mizonos. So, and it really will answer almost every question in Choshen Mishpat. Not every question, but so many questions are answered in Choshen Mishpat based on this fundamental issue of who is considered the muchzak. And so, therefore, we have to. So, whoever is the muchzak, they're the holder. The other person who is trying to take away, they're the motzi. A motzi mechavei ol averaya. Burden of proof is always coming on the person who's trying to extract money from the person who's holding. So over here, the question is, who's the holder? Now, it is a bit of a funny question, meaning who's the holder? Wouldn't you argue simply that the estate is the holder? Meaning they're the ones who are literally holding the money. So as we're about to see in the Gemara is going to articulate that you can actually argue this in one of two ways. Let's see the Gemara do so. We're on the top of Tzadi Vavam and Beis. So let's argue first that really the Yisomim are the holders of that money. And it's the widow to come and bring a proof. The Gemara doesn't really have to elaborate over here. It's kind of self-evident. Meaning, they're the ones who are physically holding the money. So, therefore, they're the muchzak. And now the widow says that, you didn't pay me. They said we did. So the burden of proof falls upon her. Okay.
How did she prove that?
I know. I saw the question coming.
Maybe she's asking. She has to have witnesses that they didn't pay.
It's going to be difficult. Meaning, right, to bring proof of a non-event.
Right.
I understand. I understand it's a challenge. Okay. Oh, Dilma, I'm with you. I don't really know what the solution to that problem is, but at least that's one That's one possibility. Or no, maybe the possessions are in the widow, and therefore it's the yesomim. Now, what does that mean that it's by the widow? That's hard to imagine. But if it's not hard to imagine when you see a short Rashi, again, very short Rashi, but very significant in this discussion. See the third line down in Rashi, becheskas amanakaimi, that the mezonos are by her. Shari nishtabdu b'tanai beizdin. So she has a shibud. She has a lien on that property, and that lien on the property makes her a strong holder of that property. And this is what Rashi cites as Tanai Beis Din, meaning this is not only contractual agreement, but contracted by Beis Din. So in other words, she doesn't just simply have an agreement in terms that she made with the estate, with her late husband, and now that agreement is going to have to be satisfied by the estate. This is something that was created by Beis Din. The construction of every marriage, woven into every marriage, is Tanai Ksuva, is that Beis Din stipulates and Beis Din says, you're going to have to do this for him, you're going to have to do this for her, and you have all those agreements that are made. So over here, she is contractually agreement, that's an act of Beis Din, that they are mezonos, so she has a shibud, she has a lien now against that obligation. That lien is so strong that right now the Gemara is viewing as a possibility that she is a muchzak on that property, and therefore she's the holder of that property, and they, the estate, the burden of proof is going to fall on them.
So what is she claiming?
She has a property. In other words, no. They're still, as we'll discuss, later, they're still going to have to hand the money over to her. Meaning she's not.
She has a shibud, but it's not.
But that shibud is. That, I understand that, but that's. I understand that it's a chiddush. We're saying a chiddush, but the shibud is like she has a chazaka. It's agreed. Okay, Tashma. So okay, good. So basic question: there's a dispute between them, and who's the burden of proof fall upon? So Tashma Dini Levi. So the Gemara quotes a brisa in the name of taught to us by Levi. Amana calls Mashalon Nisays Ali Yisam LaHavi Raya. Good, done. A widow, anytime that she has not yet remarried, so then it's the orphan's responsibility to bring a proof. So Nisays Ala LaHavi Raya. So, and once she remarries, and then she's claiming mezonos. Now, that's a little bit strange. Meaning, once she remarries, she has no longer claim to mezonos. The Bryce is describing a scenario where she's asking for back pay. That's how Rashi explains it. He bought litzvo mezonos shel shanim shavru. Meaning years have gone by, and by the way, based on the Gemara that we just saw a couple of minutes ago, it can't be greater than 2 or 3 years. But in other words, she's entitled to back pay. She deserves it. It's part of the requirement. And after she gets married again, remarried again, her holding of the estate obviously has been diminished. Probably could state a little bit better, a little bit stronger. It's probably been relieved because she's remarried. But anyway, but she's still entitled to that back pay. But now she has the burden of proof and burden of responsibility. But anyway, you saw from the beginning of the Bryce, it's very clear that the burden of proof falls upon the Yisomim to say that we actually paid her. I'm Rabbi Shimi Barashi Kitanai. The Gemara points out that this is subject to a machlokus amongst Tanayim. Mocheres v'koseves eilu mezonos mecharti v'eilu ksuva mecharti. Div Rav Yehuda. Okay. Bryce, we're going to see right now is as follows. She is going to be selling off properties. She's selling off properties in order to satisfy. And again, the estate right now has two basic financial obligations to her. One which is latent and one which is real in the present. Number one, mezonos. Right? They have to support her. And that is going to require money. And if they don't have the money, so properties are going to have to get sold off in order to feed the almano.
Has she seized it or does she have authority to do this?
She's going to have some basic authority to do this. We'll talk later this morning about what the general process is. But anyway, so she sells off property. So now, when she sells off property, so it's going to have to be, that sale is going to have to be for the satisfaction of that obligation of mezonos. Additional to that, there's also an obligation of ksuva. In other words, that the settlement that is the prenuptial settlement that's agreed upon between husband and wife, and again, that's also Tanai Beis Din, that's also an act of Beis Din. So that also is something where she's entitled to and she's owed. Now, mind you, once she gets the mezonos, she no longer gets, sorry, let me say that sentence again. Once she gets the ksuva, she no longer gets the mezonos, but again, those are the two basic requirements.
But the Yitomim look at it retroactively and say, listen, over the past 5 years, you've collected from his own debt to qualify.
Very good. So just wait 1 second, because your question will be answered, not simply, but it will be answered. So, Mecheres v'Kosev, Zeh L'Mezonos, Mecharti v'Laksuv, Mecharti, Divrei Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda says that on the sale, it has to be clearly identified what served as mezonos and what served as ksuva. And the we'll go on to explain his position in just a moment. And Rav Yossi, and Rav Yossi says, no, let her sell the properties, let her collect the money of the sale, let her not earmark what that monies are for, so don't give a line item on what exactly the proceeds of that sale went to, either it was mezonos or it was for ksuva, and then later on it will be better for her, says Rav Yossi. Good. That's a brisa. Now, what the Gemara is going to try to suggest is a pshat in the brisa. And maybe the pshat in the brisa goes like this. My love, v'hakim iflagi. L'rev Yehuda dam rabbi lefrushe, saver nechze b'chezka yasme kaime, v'ala manalavi raya. So the Gemara suggests that according to Rev Yehuda, she needs to clarify what that money was for. She sold the property of the estate. She collected the money. Rav Yehuda says it is her obligation to clearly identify what the proceeds of the sale went to. Why? Because, and again, this is a suggestion of the Gemara, because in the event of a dispute between her and the estate as to whether or not she collected, it will be her responsibility to prove that she didn't get paid, and therefore she should get paid. And so therefore, at the time of the sale, it has to be clearly identified why she sold it, so that she will have clear proof later on. That is a suggestion on behalf of Rav Yehuda. And Rav Yossi says, "Lo by lefrushe nechze becheskes amana kaima v'alei somlan laviraya." And Rav Yossi says, "No, it's not. It's the burden of proof is not on her. The burden of proof is on them. She's considered the mochzak. Therefore, she's in the driver's seat, and she does not have to identify why for what it was sold for." So the Gemara is suggesting that's really at the source of this machlokes between Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi. The Gemara says, "Me mine." Now, how do you know that? The Gemara says, "Let's not suggest that that's the correct understanding of the brisa. Let's suggest that according to everybody, she with her shibud is considered the muchzak. And as a result of that, it's the widows. Sorry." It's the estate who are obligated to bring a proof that they did, in fact, already pay. Rav Yehuda eats a tofa kamashmalan. And so what's at the core of this debate over here between Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi? Rav Yehuda is giving just good old advice. The lo likra le rav tenusa. Because look what's happening over here. She's selling off property. Now, what are people going to start talking about? You see the widow over there? I heard she just sold off a bunch of properties from the estate. Not knowing as to whether or not that was satisfying the mezonos or satisfying the ksuva, so people are going to suggest to one another, you know, it must be for a mezonos. She eats a lot. And once that reputation starts that she eats a lot, it will really hamper her ability to find a new husband if you have that kind of reputation. So Rav Yehuda says, you know what? Do good bookkeeping. In other words, when you sell off properties, make sure that people know that not everything went for mezonos. Some went for mezonos, some went for ksuva. So therefore, she won't go around with a bad reputation. So really, it's not a fundamental debate between Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi. It's just Rav Yehuda is just providing some good advice. Here's what we're going to suggest that you do so that you don't walk around with a bad reputation. The Gemara just wonders, you know. It seems like we're giving the right shot, because there's a Mishnah that we're going to see later on. It's coming up in today's Mishnah. We're not going to get to it, but Mecheres Mezonos Shalom Bebeizdin V'Kosev Ezeila Mezonos Mecharti. Where the Mishnah later on will tell us that she sells properties for her Mezonos. She doesn't need Beizdin. The reason is pretty intuitive. Mezonos is something she needs right here and right now. And let's not go through the judicial process of having to go to court. And you know, going through court takes time. And this is talking about her Mezonos. And she needs it today. So she could sell off properties for mezonos without Beis Din, and she has to write on the transaction that this was sold for mezonos. That's the Mishnah. Now, Rav Yochanan is asking the question: why didn't he cite the Mishnah? So Alam and Masis and Lekel Mishnah. I mean, it's a tova kamashmalan. Hachanami, it's a tova kamashmalan. Gemara says very simply, because when he looked at that Mishnah, he didn't see that Mishnah as being a fundamental issue. It was just a good practical advice. When you sell your prop, when the widow, when you sell your properties, make sure to identify what you're selling it for. People don't call you a glutton. Here too, same thing. So Inami. Okay, so the one way we just explained the machlokes between Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi, it's not a fundamental debate, it's just a question of whether we're advising or well. As Gemara suggests, look, another way to suggest explain this machlokes is to kol yamanich lebecheskas yas mikayim. Then according to everybody, really, it's in the possession of the orphans. The v'hainu time of the Rav Yossi k'da by kashisha. And now, good. So according to Rav Yehuda, it's in the possession of the orphans. Which means that if there's ever a dispute between the widow and the estate, so the burden of proof falls on her. And that then certainly allows us to understand Rav Yehuda's position very clearly. Rav Yehuda says that she's going to have to earmark and take good record of what was sold for what, because if there ever becomes a dispute, the burden of proof will fall on her. Good. That's Rav Yehuda's position, and in this next approach, in this now approach that we're learning, makes perfect sense. Now, according to everybody, the Yosoma are considered the Mokhsak, so how do you understand Rav Yossi? Why, according to Rav Yossi, is it advantageous for her to sell and not identify what's what? So the Gemara says, I'll tell you why, because Rav Yossi is really in agreement with a statement that was made by Abaye Kashish. Now, Abaye Kashish is an Amora, but in other words, obviously this is an opinion that was... We have it as Abaye Kashisha, but it must have been an earlier position. And that's the following. Damar Abaye Kashisha, Mashal Rav Yossi, Lamah Dover Doma. I'll give you an analogy for Rav Yossi so that you understand it. And the analogy goes like this. Let's say that a person was dying, and he is giving instruction, final instruction on what to do with his estate. And so, divrei shchiv mira, in other words, when you have somebody who's dying, so it's kiksuvim umusrum dami, meaning that creates a transaction just by simply him articulating. So, okay, so he's giving instruction of what to do with his estate. And so he says, you know, over there, that guy, let's call him Reuven, he was just such a wonderful guy, give him $200. Now, it happens to be that Reuven, on top of that, is also a creditor. Okay? And I guess he was a very nice creditor. So, but you know what? Give him $200. So, Ratza b'chova notlan, Ratza b'matana notlan. Now, Reuven was just, quote-unquote, gifted $200 from the dying man, and so now as a creditor, so and he's holding a note, so he obviously is owed $200. But over here, the Shechiv Merah did not give clear instruction in terms of. He gave clear instruction in terms of to allocate the money to him, but did not clearly instruct why that money is to be allocated to him. It was either going to be a gift or it was going to be a repayment of the loan. So now, how can the Baal Chov collect it? So. He can collect it either way. He can collect it as either a gift or as either a loan. Obviously, it would be to his advantage.
But if he chooses to select as a gift, doesn't he have to come and take an oath to take the money as a
not if the Shechiv Merah himself is giving instruction.
No. I'm saying for the, if he accepts as a gift,
right,
and then comes later and claims that I still haven't got my $200 loan, he has to have to get.
Okay, that's agreed.
But he has to take an oath about this money that he got, saying that this was a.
That's all well and good. He firmly believes, and he may even be right, that this money that was given to him was a gift. So when he's making a shvu, he's not saying anything that he thinks is wrong. In fact, he may be right. So im not lan, so I'm sorry, ratzam b'matana not lan, im b'matana not lan lo kach kocho yafa, and the obvious point, which we all already arrived at, is that if he takes that money as a gift, that puts them in a better position. So the good. So now let's go back to the widow. So Rav Yossi says, you know what? Better for you not to identify why you sold that property. Why? So Rashi points out over here, it's the top Rashi inside Sadi Zayin Amad Aleph, because we know, I'm going to say the Rashi outside, but let's go over what we know. We know that a woman has a note, she has a ksuva, and that ksuva allows her to collect. She has a shibud, but let's be clear. She has a shibud on the ksuva, meaning on the settlement, on the 200 or 100 of the settlement. And also the Tosefis Ksuva as well. She has a shibud on that as well. But in other words, she has a shibud. So that means then that any properties that were sold off by either the husband or the estate is not free and clear, but rather she has a lien on those properties. And she therefore is allowed to come and to collect those properties even from the buyers. Fine. She does not have a shibud on mizonos. That mizonos that's entitled to her, so that's an obligation. but it is only an obligation on the estate, and she has no lien on that on those mezonos. Any properties that are sold, she cannot come and collect those monies from the mezonos. And the reason why, we've discussed this in the past, but let's review. The reason why is because the ksuva is a finite, fixed amount. It's written into the ksuva. So we could say to any buyer who's going to buy property from the husband, look, you know that there's an outstanding obligation, and so as long as you, but it's a known entity in terms of what that outstanding obligation is, so the buyer can go and protect himself, like we discussed already a number of times, by ensuring that there's other properties still on the person of the husband. But if it's mezonos, mezonos are an unending obligation. It's not a fixed amount; it's a variable, and in terms of how long that's going to be paid off, I mean, right, as long as she lives. So now you can't, it's totally unfair to the buyer to come and say that she's going to have a lien on an obligation that's not a fixed obligation. It's going to expose the buyer to having property taken away from him, and that becomes totally unfair for the buyer. She does not have a shibud on the mezonos. Good. So now with all that stated, so now we'll go back and we'll really understand Rav Yossi. So Rav Yossi says it's really to her advantage, not when she sells off property, not to identify what those properties were sold off for mezonos or for ksuvas. Because if at a later point in time, let's say there are no properties left in the estate, and she wants to come and she wants to collect now her ksuva, so if what she sold off earlier was sold for her ksuva, so that's it, she's done. In other words, and now she's only collecting mezonos, which again, she's entitled to, but now she's done. She can't, because there's nothing there's nothing left in the estate itself. She has no shibud on the mezonos, and therefore she can't collect. So what if she leaves the identification of that sale undefined? So at a later point in time, she can now say, okay, that was for mezonos, this is for ksuva, and then it allows her to collect for that with that ksuva. Okay.
She still has a lien.
Yeah. Good. So that's the Rav Yossi says that's to her advantage. Now, mind you, by the way, just I'm going to state the obvious. According to Rav Yossi, there's still a built-in disadvantage, and that, of course, is that in a matter of dispute, so then the burden of proof is going to fall on her. Okay, so with every advantage, there's a disadvantage, and so, but still, by leaving the sale amorphous, so then you have that advantage as we just described. Like Rabbi Yossi or like Rabbi Yehuda.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, we go like Rabbi Yossi. So I didn't look up the Rambam, so I don't know. But generally, we go like Rabbi Yossi. Correct. But again, that Mishnah could just simply be Eitz Tova. Okay. Ketzad Mocheres, top of Tzadi Zayin Amud Aleph, today's daf, and how does she sell? Meaning, let's go through the actual nuts and bolts of how properties are going to be sold off. Amar Rabbi Daniel bar Rav Ketina, Amar Rav Huna, Mocheres Achas L'Shnei Masar Chodesh, V'Lokech Miparnas Achas L'Shalchim Yom. So, before we continue, there's a built-in tension. In other words, when we're selling off properties in order to provide for her mezonos. So again, the estate is obligated. So the estate doesn't have a choice in the matter. But at the same time, however, you sell off a big chunk of property, so you don't know if you're going to need all that money, and you don't want to sell off all your properties. So in other words, so you're not going to sell off a big chunk of your estate for the next 5 or 10 years.
She may die.
She may remarry.
Right.
So on one hand, on one side of this cord is the idea that you don't want to sell off. The estate doesn't want to sell off all the properties. On the other side of the cord, pulling on the other side, is the idea that you're not going to sell off a little bit of land so she can eat just today, meaning she has to eat today and she also has to eat tomorrow. And I'm pretty sure 3 days from now, she's also going to need to eat. So that there's that tension. So the estate doesn't want to sell off a lot of property. On the other hand, she needs to eat every day and she wants a little bit of security. So the balance is going to be a year. So in other words, you sell off a property that would provide enough food for 1 year, and even that, you don't give her all the money at one time, but basically you create a partner, you create a third party, and third party's entrusted with the money, she goes to the third party, and she gets a monthly allocation for her food. That is the opinion of Rav Huna. The Rav Yehuda Amar, some detailed debate in terms of how much property should be sold off. According to Rav Yehuda, enough property should be sold off for 6 months. And again, with a monthly allocation from the third party. Tanya Kavaz is Rav Huna. The Gemara quotes the Braisa supporting Rav Huna. Okay, so the Braisa says exactly like Rav Huna. And Tanya Kavaz is Rav Yehuda. And then the Gemara quotes the Braisa like Rav Yehuda. So basically what we're finding is that this debate amongst the Amoraim is really an older debate already amongst the Tanaim. Okay, so on this, the Gemara has a very resounding and clear conclusion, and that is that he should sell enough land to provide 6 months of food for her, and again, with an allocation going to her monthly.
Now, the thing is, the money sitting in escrow by the buyer, mm-hmm. and whatever is not used, the balance is supposed to go back to the Yitoma, right?
Yeah. Correct. Correct. Amalei Rav Asher Lameimar Derav Huna Mai. So they said to Rav Asher, what about Rav Huna? Now again, Rav Huna was of the opinion that you should be selling all for a year's worth of food for the amana. So Amar Lo Shmi Ali. So he says, I didn't hear it, but as we've seen time and again throughout the Gemara, Lo Shmi Ali is their way of talking, saying Lo Klamar Lo Svirli, meaning yeah, okay, I heard that, but no, I don't agree. I just simply don't agree. Selling off a year's food worth of property is too much of a burden on the estate. In other words, again, you don't know if you're going to need all that. So let's do it incrementally at a 6 month interval. Okay. The next question and answer, intellectually enjoyable, certainly going to be, I think you may have somewhat of a visceral reaction to it, but it makes sense. In other words, intellectually it makes perfect sense. Let's say she sells off the properties for her mezonos. Okay, in other words, again, she's entitled to mezonos. So she sells off the property. Like we discussed a couple minutes ago, she doesn't have a shibud for a mezonos, but she has every right and entitlement so that any property that's on the hand of the estate is subject to being sold so that she can eat. Good. And then, Masha talks of a titcher of luxuva. And now, let's say as follows. After having sold off the property, she goes back to the buyer, knocks on the door and says, hi, I'm coming to collect the property. The property that I just sold you. Because, right. In other words, that was for the sale of the mezonos. Good. Now, there's a ksuva. And now I'm entitled to the ksuva, and for the ksuva, I have a shibud. I didn't have a shibud for the mezonos, but I do have a shibud for the ksuva. And now she knocks on the door, and she comes to collect now from the... for her ksuva.
And there's no other land left for the right. Estate.
And obviously, otherwise the buyer would have been protected.
Right.
Okay. So... yes, I told you. It's so. V'titcher l'ksuva can be bailahu b'derav Yosef. So the Gemara says this question really can be formulated within Rav Yosef. Damer Rav Yosef, Amalasa dezaven achrayos ayasme ubedina dezaven achrayos ayasme. My. So let's say we have a widow, and the widow sells with achrayos. So Rashi. Rashi explains. I'm a lost of the Zab and Rashi writes. Osam Yisom Lamazon, Osol Luxuva, Vikabla Lachrayos. So let's say they sold off for a particular field. Either they sold it all for Mazonos or they sold it for Xuvas. And she accepted upon herself a guarantee. So Achrayos Ayasmi, Rashi writes. Achrayos Halakuchos, Choser Ala Yisomim. In other words, if the field was in fact taken away from the buyer, so then. Who do they have recourse against? They have recourse against the estate, so because the obligation was on them. Okay, so the I'm also the zavin achrayos ayasmi. Ubeidina the zavin achrayos ayasmi. Now the basin that sells, so the guarantee is going to fall on the yisomim. My kevin achrayos ayasmi tarfa odema masi amrla. Or so on one hand, since we have recourse that goes against the estate, so therefore they're going to get a reimbursement. On the other hand, dilma masi amrla. Or maybe we could say the following to her. Nehida achrayos da ama lo kabelta ilavech. Achrayos da nafshech lo kabula kabelt. Or maybe they could say to her the following. Look, it's one thing where, let's say, you sold us the property, and there's going to be a guarantee that if the property is taken away, so we have recourse. And again, in all these cases of recourse, I mean, good luck. Meaning, obviously, the reason why the property was taken away is because there's no money left by the seller. Okay, but still, In other words, what's right is right, and they paid good money for that property, and now they have a recourse against the estate. So, but they could say to her the following: look, it's true that when you sold us the property and you sold us with a guarantee, so we're going to get reimbursed. But in this particular case, I understand that we're supposed to make good on outsiders coming, but now it's you who's coming back, meaning you're the one who sold us the property, and now you're coming and you're knocking on the door, and now you and you want the property back. Meaning, I understand that we're going to be protected against other people, but we also have to be protected from you as well. So I'm related to Nisua. So the Gemara says, okay, we learned this in a brisa. So the Gemara quotes the Brisa, and this Brisa says as follows. Let's say we have an estate, and really not a lot left in the estate. Okay, these poor kids, they're really going to walk away penniless. But again, poor kids, poor widow. So the there's a built intention over here, obviously. So so in terms of her selling off the properties, here's how you're going to have to do the accounting. She'll sell off the properties for her mizonos until you get to the remainder equivalent to her ksuva. Once you get to that point in time, don't sell anymore. Because you now know that whatever's left over has to satisfy the ksuva, and so therefore, sell off the remainder for the ksuva, and that's it. And clearly, what's not being suggested over here in this brisa, that she keeps selling for the mizonos, and she keeps selling, and then at the end of the day, she'll come and knock on the door, and now she'll collect for ksuva because she has a shibud against the ksuva. The brisa doesn't say that, and the Gemara makes that very point. Shmamina shayara in lo shayara lo. So the Gemara says, so clearly over here, you have to leave something over. So the Gemara says once again, maybe it's not because that's the halacha, but maybe over here, once again, Eitzatova, we're giving good advice. Because imagine, where like everyone here, right, smiled as we said over this halacha. Imagine after selling all the properties for the mezonah, she comes and knocks on the door, and she says, okay, now, I'm here again because I'm Mike Suva. So good. Maybe the halacha is that she's entitled to that property once again. But you know what people are going to say? We all know. You're right. Correct. She's a hadranisa. She's somebody who goes back. Goes back over here, meaning she sold the property and she took it right back. Rightfully so. Lawfully so. But come on. So in other words, maybe it's just Eitz HaTovah, maybe it's just good advice to protect her reputation. Im kein lifnei govek sivasa min hashar. The Gemara says, you may be right, but it doesn't fit in textually to the words. Because the words of the Braisa are, she collects the ksuva from the rest. It should say, govek sivasa min hashar. My samachla. The wording of the Braisa is a little bit more articulate. It says, she somech. Meaning she's relying on the rest. So that means then that she's relying on the rest for ksuva. It's only if there's a balance can she collect the ksuva. If there is no balance, then she can't collect the ksuva. So the Gemara says that, no, she can't do that. She can't sell off all the properties for the mizonos and then knock on the door and come back later and say, hi, let me come and collect for the ksuva. And we're going to end off today with the following discussion. It is an interesting discussion, and I know it's going to prompt a lot of questions. So hold the questions until the end, and you can ask me all the questions that I won't know the answer to. So, but in the meantime, however, let's hear the following. Let's say somebody sold a property, and it turns out they sold it for money, and specifically for money, and it turns out they didn't need the money. Hadrasvina lo hadrasvina. Was that going to be enough to go back and to renege on the sale? Now, it is an interesting, I mean, just at the inception of this discussion, it is certainly interesting. In other words, was he clear at the sale that I'm selling it for money? Or was it just an umdana? Was it just understood that way? If you take a look at Rashi, so Rashi says, Zavim v'loitz terech leizuzei, Marcher sadeu, v'anu yodim shaya chafetz l'knot sadeh ploni, o pragmachi aplonis ba'os ma'os. So it sounds like from Rashi, he didn't actually articulate it, it was just known. It was just people know it. So, Tosfos goes one step further. If you take a look at Tosfos over here, it's the fourth Tosfos on the Amud. He says, "Ukegon shegila da'ato b'shas amecha." Tosfos sounds much stronger than Rashi. In other words, he said at the time of sale, "I'm selling it because I have such a great opportunity, such a great business opportunity, but I need money and I'm strapped for money, so I'm going to sell property. I hate selling my property, but right now I need the money, and so I'm going to sell my property." And then it turns out, There was no investment opportunity. He didn't need the money. So can he renege on the sale? So that's a basic question. So the Gemara is going to discuss it briefly. Hadrazina lo hadrazina tashma da ugavad azavan ara l'rav papa d'yitzrich le'zuzil mizbein turei. Person had a great opportunity to buy oxen. And so he sold this property to Rav Papa. By the way, a parenthetical note, Rav Papa was wealthy. Right, we have a number of Gemaras that indicate that Rav Papa was a very wealthy Amora. So, but anyway, so Rav Papa was, so he bought the property. And Lesof Lo Yitzrich Le. Now, the seller of the property turns out that the oxen opportunity came and went, and he didn't need the money. So, V'adrina Ni'ale Rav Papa La'are. So Rav Papa says, you know what? Okay, let's renege on the sale. So you'll give me back my money, I'll give you back your property. Okay, so Rav Papa... Now, was he doing the halachically correct thing, or was he going above the letter of the law? So the Gemara says, Rav Papa lifnei mishur sadin huda aven. So the Gemara says, Rav Papa was going above the letter of the law, and so therefore don't extrapolate from Rav Papa that that's the correct thing to do. Tashma da'u b'tzuras adava b'narda. There was a famine in the town of Narda, zavnu kule amala panayo, and then everyone sold off their houses. People needed to eat. And the prices of food was crazy. And so people sold off their properties. L'sof asuchiti. And then in comes a shipment of wheat. Amalu Rav Nachman, dinuhu dehadri apan lamarayu. So Rav Nachman says, it's the right halacha that everyone should be able to get back their houses. Excuse me. They only sold their houses only to because of a need for money. Turns out they didn't need the money, and so therefore the sale should be reneged. Hasanami zvina betausa who diglay milsa da arve beakule havekaimen. So the Gemara says, wait a second. This is not exactly the same case. Now the Gemara doesn't use this terminology. I'm using the terminology. This is more like a mekach taus. Mekach taus means that at the time of the sale, there were things that were not clear or not known or not disclosed. Right? The way the Gemara says it is that the grain was already en route. In fact, the Gemara says, Arva be'akule havekaima. It was like, it was by the port. In other words, customs, all the paperwork. But it was, in other words, it was here. So this isn't really revelatory for the previous discussion. Previous discussion was, I needed the money, and then at a later point in time, it turns out that I didn't need the money. Here, I was selling it because there was no food, and meanwhile, there was food. Now imagine where you have a buyer and seller and you can renege. Think about the next time there's going to be an attempted transaction. There's not going to be confidence in that sale. In other words, I'm going to sell you something, but you're going to renege on it later on because of a famine or a shipment of wheat. In other words, a lot of transactions based on confidence. And think about what you're doing now. So Amarle Atu Kol Yuma B'tzorat Teshchicha. So I understand, is famine's common, so common in Narada that you have to worry about such an episode? Amarle In B'tzorat Benarada Mishkach Shicha. He says, yeah, Narada, yeah, this is pretty regular. Ve'ilchasa Zavim V'lo Yitzrich Le'zuzei Hajri Zvina. And then on this point, the Gemara also comes to a very clear conclusion, and that is that if you sell for money, now again, Rashi and Tosfos, it's not perfectly clear whether or not he disclosed that point at the time of the sale. According to Tosfos, he did, but you sold something for money, and it turns out you didn't need the money. The Gemara says Hadrizvina, so then you can recant on that sale, you can renege on the sale, and that's the Gemara says is the conclusion.